can play.
Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome. This is Elder Talk. This is Joe Cordell. With me is Susan Arthur. Susan, how are you?
I'm doing all right, trying to stay cool on a nice hot summer afternoon.
Well, this is a special weekend, you know, that we're celebrating our dads. Mm-hmm. I hope that everyone listening has thought of this. But dads are important.
We're set at our house, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, dads are important. And I have to tell you, when I think about practicing elder law, you know, my parents, thankfully, are both living, but they're getting up there. And so I'm feeling in a very direct way some of the things that I've advised about over the years, but have not had to deal with personally.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of dedicate this show to many of those issues.
You know, there is nothing that makes us more aware than having to deal with the problem ourselves. I have much more compassion for people when I've gone through a particular situation. And I'm sure that the advice that you're able to give is so much more complete because you're experiencing this yourself.
It is. So let's get into the subject of this show. And keep in mind, those of you listening, the purpose of this show is to teach you, inform you about issues that are critical in many cases, in all cases, wonderfully helpful and relevant to us as we age. Many of them have to do with health care, which in fact is what we're going to focus on today. Launch us off here, Susan.
Well, we're going to actually start a series. We're going to be looking at three different things over the next 3 weeks. We're going to be talking about and tackling the subject of Medicaid and long-term care expenses. Nothing says fear to me like long-term care expenses. To think I will work my entire life and I will just have to spend everything that I've spent my entire life building and the nest egg I've built and anything that I want to do with my kids or money for my church, and it's all going to go to keeping me alive for the duration of my life.
And often this fear arrives unexpectedly. In other words, many of us whistle through our 30s, 40s, maybe even 50s, and we assume, look, we have Medicare. Medicare is to cover costs of health care. Doesn't this relate to health care? So it's done.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that misconception that floats around out there until suddenly someone somewhere clears it up. And that's the moment of terror that you're describing, when someone is suddenly struck with the possibility that they're going to be spending $10,000, $12,000, $13,000 or more thousand dollars a month, mm-hmm, to pay for their care.
You said a month, right?
A month. It's shocking.
It is.
And many of us just assume Medicare should cover that. Now, I'm going to guess that a lot of our listeners probably suspect already, probably are quite well informed, that Medicare for most of them is not going to be very helpful.
Right. I do think, you know, we're going to start off with what exactly is Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, those are two different things. And I think we both know that they cover a little bit about health care. But what's the difference? I mean, Medicare, I just heard some stuff that's like, it's going to run out of money. And I keep hearing that. And then I hear about Medicaid and I think, well, that's just for poor people. Can you clarify?
Yeah, there are these stereotypes. And let's start with what is Medicare? Medicare, of course, is wonderful. I mean, it's intended to address fixing injuries or illnesses for treatment. In other words, it's not for chronic care. It's not for what's called custodial care. If you think about what are the common denominators for most people in a nursing home, that's kind of it. Some combination of chronic care for persistent medical conditions, mm-hmm, and the other is the custodial dimension,
right,
which includes assistance with eating and sleeping and all those things that are provided, the housing aspect, et cetera. So when you think about Medicare, though, Medicare was designed to provide a medical treatment for an illness for which there is likely improvement. Now, there's been much litigation about this idea. Does it require that you can only get Medicare if it relates to a treatment that's going to result in improvement? No, but still, it has to meet the definition of treatment for an injury or an illness. And while it can include providing you services to prevent you from further loss of use of a limb, for example. In other words, there are those examples where you'd technically argue, well, the person is not getting better from this, so it's not treatment in that sense. Still, the courts have been clear that Medicare is to step in and cover that. So that picks up a fraction of the stuff that would otherwise be tossed off into the long-term care black hole problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then so then what then, I assume, by kind of the way you've explained it, that Medicaid might be helpful for more of those long-term things. And we're going to kind of look at a little bit of those things today. I mean, one of the first things that, you know, I kind of wonder is how will Medicaid help us?
Well, let me take a step back. And I just want to sort of make the listener clear about the magnitude of the problem. I mean, keep in mind as we discuss this problem that there's this tidal wave, this tsunami of people who are hitting 65, what is it, 10,000 a day, that are hitting 65 and as a result are going to be looking for assistance with their health care. We see this tide, we can see off on the horizon this tidal wave, and it's even close upon us, many of us. So the question becomes, how do we pay for this? Well, we've already talked about the limitations of Medicare. And I can tell you what's happening right now on the ground. If you look at most states, Missouri is probably representative, and you look at all the long-term care costs, would you believe that over 50% of that is actually being paid by people who are not healthcare providers? Meaning it's being provided by people who are providing what's called informal care. Informal care includes mom, dad, children, aunts, uncles, cousins, anyone who steps in, neighbors, anyone who steps in to assist people with their care that would otherwise not be able to do it. And, of course, the vast majority of those are elder people. Mm-hmm. So the vast cost, in excess of 50% of the total cost of all this care, of these trillions of dollars nationally, is actually being borne on the shoulders of people who aren't being paid.
Wow, that's just incredible.
And we can't ignore it. There's a tendency to ignore it, but there's an economic cost to that. Mm-hmm. Those of you who are listening who are, in fact, one of these caregivers, you're in fact one of these people who call a sandwich generation. You're busy raising your kids at the same time. You're taking time every evening, every morning, maybe parts of every weekend to address things with your parents because you love them. You're determined that they have these things addressed, and there's no one else to do it. Mm-hmm. So this informal care occupies more than 50% of the total cost, and we have to wonder what is the societal cost that is being exacted that we're not exactly measuring in bank accounts and in budgets of governments. And we know it's real, but how will we feel it as a society? There's an incredible amount of burnout of the people who are fulfilling this role.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. I mean, I think you see it maybe even in health costs for the caregiver themselves, because all of a sudden they are exhausted. I mean, you know, they're up early, they're running over to mom or dad's, they're making sure mom or dad's got pills. They've you know, transported them to the hospital or gotten them to the doctor's appointments, trying to then get their teenager somewhere else, and then
it's
collapse
real
at the end of the day.
It's real.
It is.
And people who think that this is something that because we don't assign a number to it in a government budget or even a private budget, they suggest that it's not a cost that we're bearing, but it is a cost, and we will fill it in different ways. The attention, the time you can give your children, for example, apart from the point that you raised, which is a very good one about the effect on the health of caregivers. Well documented, that is, incidentally. Mm-hmm. So we know that there's lots of cost. Well, of the care that's being provided that is being paid for, where's that money coming from? Well, these numbers tend to be pretty consistent across the country. About 10% is coming from some form of long-term care insurance. Now, it'll vary a little bit, a few percentage points from state to state. But around 10% of this formal cost. This is the cost that we can identify associated with long-term care. Another 20% is from private resources. These are the people who have the ability to write a check. There are people who can pull out their checkbook and say, oh, $15,000 this month, sure, no problem.
But yeah, that's not most people.
It's not most people. And it also, though, would include some middle-class people who I would argue have not adequately explored the possibilities and who believe that it's necessary for them simply to exhaust that $300,000-$500,000 they might have saved. Mm-hmm. I mean, these have been people who've been net givers to the economy. these haven't been takers.
Right.
So when you look at the bell curve and you look at that big bulge in the middle, these are the middle-class people in America. These are the ones who are facing the crisis that we're talking about now. It's not the poor. And the reason it's not the poor is because they readily qualify. They understand, you know, where to get these benefits for the most part. And they do have Medicaid and other benefits available. Meanwhile, on the other extreme are the people who are the affluent. And the affluent, for the most part, don't have a problem, meaning that they assume they're going to pay for it. Many of them have even budgeted to pay for it. So for them, what we call a crisis is not really a crisis.
Right.
So interestingly enough, the people who are experiencing a crisis are the people who their whole lives have been givers.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't signed up for programs. They haven't been recipients for anything. They're very self-conscious about the idea that they might be applying for some program. They feel as if, gee, I shouldn't do this. So for these people, they hit the late 50s, maybe they hit early 60s. Many of them only then find out that, no, Medicare doesn't cover this, and no, your other insurance doesn't cover this. And so they're struck with this financial crisis in addition to health concerns. So for these people, they want to know, how do I pay for this? Medicare, turning to Medicare, I can tell you that it does provide benefit for a certain number of days when you transfer from a hospital. It has to be what's called a qualified stay in a hospital. Usually that amounts to 3 midnights. It'll be a 3-night rule. But really, the way they calculate it, it has to be done carefully. But if you meet that qualifying stay from hospital, then you can get up to 100 days coverage in a skilled care facility. Sometimes these are attached to hospitals, sometimes they're not.
So that would be maybe when there's still the intent of getting better. So you've stayed for the 3 days, and then that's kind of like you're transferred to skilled care or skilled nursing homes. I've heard that phrase.
Yeah.
And so that's part of what this is.
And generally, yeah, generally it will meet this definition because it's in everyone's interest to interpret the facts in a way that are helpful, but you know, are truthful but helpful. And often there's not a lot of pushback for that up to 100-day period in which people will be in a nursing home. But then after that, then the nursing home is quite frank that they've got to have a source of payment. So during that first 100 days, not all that's paid, incidentally. Now, during the first 20 days, for the most part, it is. For the next 80 days, as I recall, off the top of my head, around 80% or so, it varies, can be covered. But the point is, you'll have a substantial copay for that period of time.
Okay, so you will get the bill for that.
Yeah, you will.
Okay.
But then thereafter, you're on your own. And for people needing care with long-term issues, these chronic issues we've talked about, we all know the 100 days is not going to solve the problem.
Right, right.
So we recognize that Medicare is wonderful. It may help us during a period of time in which we might be getting care in a skilled care facility. But then we have to figure out, what do we do from here? And we know that when we look at those percentages of how people pay for long-term care, these are the people who are actually paying out of pocket in some form. There's actual payment. 10% insurance, 20% personal resources, and the other 70% is Medicaid.
Wow.
Yeah,
70%. Well, okay, so let's cycle back around to that middle bell curve. Let's look at maybe some of the things that I would consider, you and I have talked, myths of Medicaid. And so let's kind of look at
There are a lot of those myths, incidentally.
There are, and if you just do a quick Google search, you're going to find lots and lots and lots of them. But we have identified 5 or 6 that we think are really important. So let you talk about the first one.
And let me add here, though, Susan, and let people know, there was competition for this list, meaning when we think of all the myths that are out there. Now, I hope that there's not someone sitting out there thinking that I don't even know enough about this topic to have heard a myth. And there are some people who know nothing about Medicaid,
right.
But I'm willing to bet the majority of the people listening have heard some of these myths. So our challenge was, when Susan and I decided to get together and pick things that we think are myths, there are so many of them in this area. So much conventional wisdom, for lack of a...
There is, and lots of confusion. So we're going to hopefully alleviate some of that confusion. So the first myth that we identified that you're going to address is, to be Medicaid eligible, you have to sell your house and give it to the government.
Now, I'm wondering, I wish I could have a show of hands. I'm willing to bet that a lot of people are out there thinking, yep, I've heard that.
Yeah. Exactly. You have to be broke. That's what I've always heard. You have to be broke.
It kind of makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, the fact that you've heard your whole life that Medicaid is for poor people, mm-hmm. right? There's mm-hmm. that myth. And yet the reality is that, as I pointed out a while ago, that the people facing the health care crisis is the middle class, and they're the ones who are having to confront this qualification process. Mm-hmm. And they know very little about Medicaid, and right. it's stereotyped in their mind. And I think that's part of the problem, incidentally, is this reluctance to look at it because it carries a stigma to them.
Well, can you address that? I mean, we'll get back to our myths, but I do think that's a very important point that you've brought out, is I do think for a lot of people, just as you said, they are the people that were givers. They were not takers. And there is a little bit of that stigma.
That discomfort.
It's very much a discomfort that he says, well, I just wouldn't even do that. I mean, that would be wrong. Or, I mean, some people might even feel like it's morally wrong to go, well,
yeah,
I've heard that. I have the money. Why shouldn't I just spend it all?
Well, and here's my argument is, I mean, let's take it for granted. These are people who have funded programs their entire working careers. And so here they come to a point in their life where, despite their best efforts, despite their heroic efforts at self-sufficiency, they're at a point where they realize that this nut that they're facing regarding health care is going to liquidate what little money that they've accumulated. Now, keep in mind, if you look at the tax revenues over the last 50 years, the vast majority of revenues come from the middle class. And anyone who thinks that the rich are providing the bulk of tax revenues, you need to look at those numbers mm-hmm. because there simply is not enough of them to meet anywhere near the majority of the revenues that are needed. And, of course, we know the poor are not. So it's the middle class that has borne the tax burden. They've paid for the programs from which everyone else has benefited. Now they've come to a point in time where they're being told that they have to, the government is saying to them, look, we're happy to help you. We're more than happy to help you with your long-term care costs. And I promise you, as soon as you get down to $1,999 in Illinois, in Missouri, $999, then we will come in and we'll provide you some help.
$1,000.
That's not a satisfactory answer.
Yikes.
So people are saying, you mean that the money that I had, despite the taxes I've paid, that I've managed to save, and that I intended as a legacy for my children, my grandchildren, though it's not much, this is all there is, I have to liquidate this to provide custodial care for me in my final years? Many simply are not willing to do that. But we still come back to the point you raised, this discomfort, this stereotype. So there's this ambivalence that we see in our clients, and I try to dispel that because I fervently believe that it's perfectly appropriate. It's even good stewardship. When I talk to people in my church, many people in churches especially are prone to think maybe this isn't a right or good thing. Mm-hmm. But I point out to them, look, it's well settled that we know we have an obligation to pay no more taxes than the law requires, which means availing ourselves of all loopholes, tax breaks, exclusions, etc. People are more than happy to do that. Mm-hmm. I suspect many of our listeners have CPAs that they count on to do that.
Sure, we itemize every year.
Yeah, and this is nothing more than that. This is using the law. This is not abusing the law. And maybe when we talk about a few of these myths here, that'll become more clear. But let me make clear, qualification for Medicaid is not about abusing the law. Okay. It's about utilizing it in the same way that you utilize your tax planning. And it means good stewardship. And it's by that good stewardship that you can hope to have something left for yourselves and especially for your children and grandchildren.
Yeah, that's great information. All right, let's move on then to myth number two.
Okay, well, and I'm sorry, I didn't completely handle one, did I?
Well, we talked about it.
Well, yeah, no, right. but it was
so you
the
don't
house.
Have to sell your house to the government.
You don't have to give everything away. And so I didn't make that real clear, but I want people to know that there are some general rules where, for example, when you have a house, you can continue to live in the house. And when you have to move out of the house, as long as you have an intention to return, and that's defined very liberally, then it means you can keep your house up to equity of $550,000 and some change. So what that means is that someone who wants to qualify for Medicaid, they don't have to sell their house. They can go in. They can actually be inside a facility, a skilled care facility. The home can be there, especially where they have a spouse that continues to live there. Mm-hmm. There's much concern about avoiding the impoverishment of spouses in federal legislation to protect what's called the community spouse. That's the spouse that continues, you know, to live outside the nursing home. The other is the institutional spouse. I hate to use these phrases, but I want people to, as they explore this subject, they need to have some familiarity with these terms. And community spouse, whenever they hear that phrase from an eligibility specialist or another person in this process, then that means the person not in the nursing home, there's an institutional spouse. So as long as there's a community spouse, then the home can be retained. Now, if there is not a community spouse, for whatever reason, then there has to be some intention to return to the house. And granted, that can be interpreted very broadly. As a matter of fact, historically, what the Social Security Administration or the Social Services has done is they have generally accepted the word of the person who's inside the facility. In other words, they just haven't questioned it, so that they could retain the home until they pass away. And then that's when what's called asset recovery is done. And let me make clear, though, before we leave this, while you get to live in your home and not have it sold out from under you, even while you're in a nursing home, probably, it is not to be confused with the idea that you can keep the home forever to give to your family. In Missouri, as in all the states, there's this rigorous asset recovery process in which the Attorney General's office is commanded by statute, at the risk of losing Medicaid matching funds, that they have to vigorously pursue repayment from the assets from the estate of people who have received Medicaid. So if you've received $1 million worth of benefits from Medicaid, then the Attorney General's office will commence an action to recover what portion they can from your estate that would be there, and the house especially is vulnerable. So there anything I say today, because the limits of time, these are, you know, there are many things I could add in terms of details, but I'm speaking in general rules here,
right.
And I just want people to understand that.
Right. Generalities, not specifics. And if you have a specific question, feel free to call Joe during the week, and he'll be happy to answer it for you. All right, let's move on to myth number two. It is against the law to give away your assets in order to qualify for Medicaid. True or false?
And, of course, that's false. It's like the idea that you give things away, you do charitable giving to gain a tax advantage. Is that illegal? And there are many things you might do to gain a tax advantage that are perfectly legal, in fact, encouraged. So similarly here, it's not the question of illegality. So when someone says, and I think that's what underlies this, is people are told, well, gee, if I give something away, then there's this penalty, and they're interpreting this to mean that there's some sort of criminal penalty. It's not a criminal penalty at all, and it's unfortunate, really, that the word penalty is used, but it's used by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. That's really not the descriptive term. It means that there's a waiting period before you're eligible to receive Medicaid. So an example would be, let's assume that you gave $100,000 to your daughter, and you did this with the intention of applying for Medicaid. So there's the 60-month look-back period, which some people are familiar with. We'll, I think, come to it here in a few minutes if we have time. But this is the general rule that the Medicaid eligibility specialist will look back for 60 months to determine if you've made an uncompensated transfer. It's simply looking for whether you've done things to impoverish yourself, qualify for Medicaid. So there are various qualifications to that general rule, which we don't have time to go into, but continue with this example. So let's assume that within that period of time, you gave $100,000 to your daughter. Well, you've not committed a crime. You've not committed a fraud. As long as you disclose this in any sort of application for Medicaid, then it's perfectly fine. It's just that it would have consequences. And so the consequence would be that there'd be a waiting period. And the way that that's determined is to, every state has a divisor. It's called a nursing home or Medicaid cost divisor. And for Missouri, it's roughly $5,000, give or take. So if you take the $100,000 and divide it by $5,000, that means that there's 20 months of weight as a result of that gift. Mm-hmm. So you didn't commit it. Somebody didn't commit a crime by giving $100,000 to their daughter.
Right.
It does mean there's a consequence that they're going to have to wait, in this case, 20 months in order to be eligible to start receiving Medicaid. So it's fine to give things away, but I would argue you should give things away when you've done it strategically, when you've calculated what the consequences are of that. And incidentally, there are ways to make such transfers where you don't incur a penalty, and that's kind of part of what we call Medicaid planning.
Well, and that's what I was wondering. Does it matter the amount? I mean, I've kind of heard this, if it's something under $10,000, there's not a, I mean, I'm not sure exactly where, but I remember this $10,000 amount for something.
Well, I think that some people think that you can make a gift of $10,000, and really what they're referring to, it used to be $10,000, is that there's a rule regarding tax law in which you can make gifts. Now that number, incidentally, is $14,000 and some change. So it's changed. But the idea is a confusion of tax law with rules regarding Medicaid. That rule has nothing whatsoever to do with Medicaid planning.
Okay, so we've got to plan ahead for our Medicaid giving. All right, myth number three. You can't get Medicaid if you've given away assets within the last 60 months. We just started on that.
Yes.
Let's keep going.
Well, and here, let me drill down a little further with what I said a few moments ago. Yes, there is this waiting period if you've given something away within 60 months. But, you know, this is all definitional. For example, is it giving something away if you purchase a Medicaid annuity? And it's not. But it does mean that your asset disappears, your asset's gone, and now what you're receiving is income, but it's not considered a charitable transfer. What if you take money and you spend it on enlarging your home? Clearly, that's not a transfer.
Mm-hmm.
It's not captured by that. Does it result in $100,000 that was cash sitting in a bank that would have been readily available and considered for qualification for Medicaid? Yes. Does it convert that into something that's not considered because it's now in the house? Well, yes. Is it permitted? For the most part, yes, it is. So there are many qualifications to this idea that you have to wait 60 months from the time that you've given something away. It is a general rule. So I do like to kind of start with that, and then clients are often surprised to see all the limitations and all the qualifications that accompany it.
What about a charitable gift? You know, many people like to fund certain charities. If you give that away, is there still a waiting period?
Yeah, there is.
There
if you is. Make a charitable gift, for the most part, if you make a charitable gift to an organization, then yes. There are some gifts that can be made to pools where you don't have the same calculation. But for the most part, yeah, anytime you make what's called an uncompensated transfer, then there's a consequence.
All right, well, let's keep going. We are moving right along with our myths. So let's kind of look now at maybe...
Should we take a quick break?
Let's take a break, sure.
Why don't we take a break before we go into the next one? This is Elder Talk. We'll be back in just a moment.
Listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors, and now attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Well, Susan, let's continue with our discussion of myths associated with Medicaid.
Well, another myth that we've kind of touched on these, and a lot of them seem to relate a little bit, but they are uniquely, they're kind of different as well. So let's see. All right, so we've talked about the 60 months, but those who have heard about Medicaid and nursing homes, they've probably heard about the 60-month rule. But hopefully what they're wondering is that if mom gives away money during, you know, 36 or 60 months, whatever the rule is, applying for Medicaid, she has to wait another 36 months or 60 months. I mean, 60 months
well,
is 5 years.
Yeah, that has to do with what people think is the impact of their making a gift. Some people think that, oh, if I've given anything away within the 60-month look-back period, then it means I have to wait another 60 months before I'm eligible. So there are two two time periods here, and one relates to how far back do the officials for Medicaid services or Social Services Missouri, how far back do they look in order to determine if you've made a gift that's going to have an impact on your qualification? That's the 60 months. How far back do you look? Now, what is the impact if it turns out, oh, someone has made a gift within the 60-month period? Then there's a different calculation. That's the one we mentioned a while ago, where you take whatever amount of money that is. If it's $100,000, we talked about the divisor being $5,000, which is pretty will be consistent. So if it's $10,000, your divisor is $5,000. So how many months do you wait in order to get your coverage? So in a case where you'd given that $10,000 away, it's just 2 months.
Okay.
Meaning take $10,000, divide it by the Medicare cost or nursing home cost in Missouri divisor, which is this average of costs for care in Missouri. Every state's different. Take that and divide it into the amount that you've given away. So you may have gone back, they may go back 4 years and find that you made a gift of $40,000. It doesn't mean that you wait 1 year. It doesn't mean you wait 5 years. It means now that you know that the $40,000 is within the window to be considered, then you divide it by the $5,000.
Okay.
Which is the divisor.
Well, see, and I think there could be lots of scenarios out there where mom and dad have maybe helped someone buy a home, one of their kids helped with a down payment or
with the best of intentions.
Well, and not even thinking that they're going to need nursing home care at all. I mean, if it's 4 years down the road, a lot can happen with someone's health in 4 years, and all of a sudden that one-time gift is a liability for them.
Yeah, and another way that this same concept comes up, where in some cases it's inadvertent, is people will add a loved one's name to an account, and maybe that account will be used by those people, like putting your children's name onto your checking account or putting your children's name on other brokerage accounts, etc. That's commonly done. Incidentally, sometimes that's intended as an estate planning thing.
Mm-hmm.
If, in fact, they have used it, then any of those funds that were used by that loved one would be considered an uncompensated transfer. And technically, to the extent that you put someone's name on an account, in legal terms, it's a gift of half of the account.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So there's a bit of a question about intent. And often there is no intent to transfer ownership. The intent is simply to do some estate planning. People are trying to avoid probate, so they figure, gee, by adding somebody's name. The better way to do it is not to give them an ownership interest, not simply add them as a co-owner. That's an awful way to do that, incidentally.
And I see so many people do that.
Oh, they do it with lots of assets.
Because I want to help mom write checks. I want to be able to write a check because she's, you know, having trouble paying your bills.
Yeah, then get a power of attorney. You know, there are better ways to do it, but it's an awful way. Whenever you put people's names on your assets, then whatever happens in their life affects those assets because the law considers those half theirs. And so if they have a car accident, the law may consider all of it theirs, depending on the particular facts.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just an awful idea, apart from what it raises here. And it raises here what appears to be a gift of at least half, maybe more, of this asset.
That could really get you into trouble. So what does when you talk about this look back period, what do they look at? Do they look at who looks at it, and how do they know? I mean,
it's a good question. It's a very good question. So the way that Medicaid is set up, it's called, incidentally, Missouri Health Net. So whenever you hear the phrase Missouri Health Net used, then that's talking about the Medicaid program in Missouri. So the primary responsibility for administering it is through the Social Services Department. And then within the Social Services Department, those who are entrusted primarily on a local level for determining eligibility and assuring that other things are administered correctly on a county-by-county basis is the Family Support Division. So Family Support Division has what's called eligibility specialists in every county. And these eligibility specialists are charged with looking at the financial documents that you will complete. And incidentally, be prepared if you're going to make any sort of application by this. Number one, please consult a lawyer in advance. It's very unlikely that you're going to get this right on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And elder lawyers in particular focus in this area. so they tend to be more familiar with it, generally speaking, than estate planning lawyers. Nothing against estate planning lawyers. They're very smart and very good at what they do, but most of them do not handle Medicaid matters, quite frankly. And that's kind of, in large part, how the practice area of elder law came into being. Was it was concerned largely with health care issues, in addition to other things, but all things elder, as the name implies. But it was triggered by crises relating to health care, which estate planners simply were not equipped to deal with, because estate planning lawyers, you know, have to master a lot about tax issues for typically wealthy clients, and so there are things that fully occupy them, mm-hmm. and most of them on the radar screen was not figuring out the arcane rules of Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
So there will be a form that will be submitted, and that it's very important you get this form right. If you don't, it can set you back for a while in order to get it clarified and straightened out, if ever. The form will ask you to provide documentation, so be prepared if you're making any sort of application for Medicaid. You're going to have to dig out, going back 60 months, documents that will relate to checks written or relate to receipt of income from any source. Now, not that if you don't have all this, it's not that the door is slammed shut, but you may be asked to go locate it and you know, make another effort to find it. And they are persistent about these things, because if you think about it, how else will they ever discover if someone has engaged in these transactions, intentionally or unintentionally? Mm-hmm. So you can see Medicaid's position,
right,
being devil's advocate, a position I'm not normally, the side of the table I don't normally occupy, but I get it, that if they don't say to you, you've got to bring me proof that you haven't given away $1 million in the last 5 years,
right.
And I think that's fair to a point. So when they go to fill this out, they'll come in and they'll submit these documents to this eligibility specialist. There's a book called An Income Maintenance Manual, IMM. You can read, I don't have the website off the top of my head, but there's a link that you can find online if you put in that phrase, IMM, Income Maintenance Manual, which, despite the name, is not very helpful in telling you what it's about. But what it is it tells you what an eligibility specialist is going to look at to determine if you're eligible. So it's a wonderful booklet to have. Incidentally, courts have ruled regarding this. It isn't law. So while it's important to know that the person that you're meeting with in your local county is somebody who's being led and their judgment is being dictated in large part by this book, it's important to know, though, that it's not law and it can be challenged. But it's good to know those rules. Those rules will determine when or if someone is going to qualify, at least in the short term, they'll determine that.
And so then do you, in terms of proof, you have to take bank statements and all of that kind of stuff? I mean, I can see a lot of people, you know, someone has just passed away, or a lot of times as someone ages, they're not keeping up with their home maintenance and home, you know, papers the way that they might have done when they're mm-hmm. younger and things like that. I just thought, oh my goodness, I can't imagine trying to find all of that just to prove that, but I assume that's what you have to do, or?
Yeah, but here's what's at stake. I mean, once you qualify, you're done. And if you think that, let's use the number 15,000. Now, granted, you can find long-term care for less than 15,000 a month right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think realistically, unless the person listening to us is going in for care tomorrow or a year from now, many people can very well budget 15,000 rather than the 12 or 10 that they might budget today. For I'm talking about quality nursing home care mm-hmm. in an urban area. Let me assert parenthetically here that granted, if you're getting nursing home care in a rural area, not just in Missouri, but pretty much in any state, those tend to be less expensive. But they're less expensive for a reason. Mm-hmm. I don't want to pick on them, but often they're not as nice. Certainly, they're not close to the cultural opportunities. They're not close to the medical care that people want, wonderful hospitals, wonderful shopping, all those things that are available in urban areas, and often their children, incidentally, might also have jobs in those same areas. So if they make the assumption that they might easily spend $15,000 a month for this long-term care, do some math. I mean, think that, is it reasonable that you or your spouse could end up 36 months? So 36 months, what is that? It's over $500,000.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of money that, that people can very quickly spend. And if you have savings, for example, we met with someone recently who there was a diagnosis of some sort of dementia. And it was foreseeable that, that while this person will be okay for a while, clearly they could project out and anticipate that in 2 to 3, maybe 5 years, that they will need long-term care. So mm-hmm. given the fact that this person is otherwise healthy, reasonably healthy for his age, then there's no reason to think that that stay, once it commences, is going to end in a year or 2 years or 3 years. I mean, it more likely would go in excess of 5 years. So when you do that math and calculate what you can be pretty confident is on the horizon, mm-hmm. I mean, this in this example, it's not just speculation. I mean, this person, we have this diagnosis, we know the trajectory of the disease, we know that there can be a substantial period of time that you live, you know, beyond a time when you can be fully independent. Mm-hmm. So I think that in those cases, yeah, it's a hassle to gather all these documents and to comply with all these rules. But once you qualify, then you're good.
We talked a little bit earlier, I wanted to cycle back to one other thing when we talked about the spouse still living in the home, and then that there's this payback after the institutional spouse, and we have the spouse that's still living in the home. Let's say in this scenario that the spouse in the facility has passed away, but the spouse that is living in the home is still there. So how does that work when you still have, I mean, Medicaid has obviously paid for.
They've paid money.
And paid a lot of money, perhaps, for this spouse or, who is no longer living. And then, but there's still somebody at home. So how does that work? I mean, you know,
yeah.
You don't want to be out on the street, but.
Well, I can tell you that Medicaid in Missouri and all states, to my knowledge, are still allowing this spouse to live out their days in that home.
Okay.
I don't know of any collection effort that was undertaken as long as that spouse is living there, or even a disabled and dependent child, the same thing. But the question becomes, what happens when the spouse dies? And there are some states, and I've seen this in Missouri too, where they didn't act. They kind of lost interest. It's kind of like when the recipient died, they immediately looked around, as I described a while ago, the Attorney General's office must do this. They immediately looked for assets they can get. Oops, in the house is a surviving spouse. So let's move on. And it's like they never circle back. Mm. And I have to tell you that still commonly happens. There's no question they have the power and the authority to circle back and collect that asset at the death of the surviving spouse. But I can tell you that what I've seen is that it's not being done. So, yes, there is this vigorous effort to get paid back when the person dies, to identify assets in that person's estate. But there's just not the follow-up that's necessary in order to track that house for later that I know of. Now, maybe it's happened in some counties in Missouri. I know that they have the authority. There's no question that if Medicaid decides they're going to start vigorously doing that, they can do it. One thing let me point out, too, before we run out of time, is that another thing that is helpful to people is while there is this general rule that you have to be down to, in Illinois, like $2,000, Missouri, $1,000, so you have to be broke, in other words, that's mm-hmm. the general rule. But yet, among the qualifications are, I mentioned a while ago that there's big concern about, at one time, the community spouse, the person who's not in the nursing home, was literally impoverished. I mean, there was a rule in place that until it was changed in 1993, OBRA, Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act, until that was changed, you literally had people who were living, who were thrown out of their homes. The husband or the wife, the one that was not in the nursing home, was put out of their homes. They're living with relatives. They didn't have any source of support because they had to do that in order for.
That's what I was afraid of. I thought, poor grandma.
Thankfully, the statute was passed, and so the statute says that the state has to provide money that's available. So. Some rules to keep in mind, those of you listening. Assets are considered as belonging to both husband and wife. So if you own it, if either of you own an asset, doesn't matter when you move the title back and forth, it still is going to be counted. Keep that in mind. So between husband and wives, the assets are counted. Now you might say, well, then I assume the same is true for income. And the answer to that is no. For reasons that, I mean, I get it. They should give break one or the other. But when they made this change in 93, then they changed the rule so that now it's the name on the check. This was something intended to protect the community spouse. So if a community spouse had income, thankfully, for mm-hmm. this change, so now if they had income coming in, they got to keep it because it was theirs. And it didn't interfere with their spouse's Medicaid qualification. So income, think name on check.
Okay.
So for income, name on check. Assets, doesn't matter name, right? Between husband and wife.
So it sounds like the government got one right.
Yeah, and that and it allows planning opportunities, too. It allows you to do some really cool planning things by you playing those two rules against each other.
All right. Well, we have had a lot of really, really good information. We've addressed some myths. We've gone over some of those things. Let's just run through them really, really quickly again.
How much time do we have?
We have about 2 minutes left.
2 minutes. Okay. Let's use them wisely.
So to be Medicaid eligible, you do not have to sell all your house to the government.
Yes. Don't sell your house. As a matter of fact, it's worse than that. I'll make this short. If you sell your house, the money suddenly becomes countable. So it's not as if it's an innocent mistake. If you take a $100,000 house and convert it into $100,000, guess what? Now you have an asset that will be an obstacle to qualification.
It's almost the opposite, yeah. All right, it's not against the law to give away your assets in order to qualify for Medicaid?
No. That may be a penalty, and it will be typically, but no, it's no legal issue whatsoever.
All right, you still can get Medicaid if you've given away assets within the last 60 months. There's just that $5,000.
Yeah, a simple calculation.
You need to plan ahead. Let's see, what else did we have? Oh, goodness. We had the one more myth here about the look-back rule. It is 60 months right now.
Yes.
And so that
It was 36 months, and this was changed in, 07? So it became the 60-month, and many people thought, oh, geez, that's going to have a huge adverse impact. But, you know, we discover new techniques, methods, et cetera. And so we adjust and go on.
And we take full advantage of the laws that are there.
Yes.
No, not abusing them, but taking full advantage of them because they are there for a purpose.
They're there. And people have a stewardship obligation to be wise in using their assets.
Well, we are going to continue this discussion next week talking about Medicaid, and we'll be looking at some other really interesting information about this. And so we want you to join us again next week.
Yes. Now keep in mind that we're here at this time each week, and it's Elder Talk. And we'll continue for the next 3 weeks on this topic. Until then, this has been Elder Talk. Thank you, Susan Arthur. Talk to everyone then.
You've been listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. That's eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.